Pull up a chair. I want to take you somewhere cold. It's a little before 4 in the morning, Moscow time, June 18, 1937. There's a concrete runway just outside the city, and sitting on it is the strangest-looking airplane you ever saw. One engine up front, and then wings. Enormous wings. Wings so long and so thin they look like they belong on a glider, not on a machine that's about to try something nobody has ever done. The thing is gassed up so heavy it can barely waddle. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, and today we're going to talk about three men, one engine, and a line drawn straight across the top of the world. Let's get into it. Now, before I tell you this story, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. This show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, your first solo, your private, your instrument rating all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of them tells a story. The fellas in this story I'm about to tell you, they didn't get a coin. They got a parade and a handshake from the President of the United States, but you and me, we can settle for a good coin in the pocket. Check them out at AviationSold.com. Every coin tells a story. Speaking of stories, the airplane was called the ANT-25. Tupolev built it. Andrei Tupolev, one of the great Soviet designers, and the whole airplane was built around a single idea. Range? Distance? The ability to fly farther without stopping than anybody alive. Everything else got sacrificed to that one god. That's why the wings are so absurdly long, 113 feet of wingspan on an airplane that only weighs a few tons empty. Most of that wing is fuel tank. The thing is basically a flying gas can with a propeller bolted to the nose. One engine. A single liquid-cooled V-12, the M-34, making somewhere around 900 horsepower when it was happy. And I want you to sit with that for a second, one engine. Over the North Pole, where if it so much as coughs you are not landing on a nice grass strip, you're going into the ice, and the ice does not call search and rescue. Now here's where it gets interesting. The man in the left seat was Valery Shkalov. And if you've never heard that name, let me fix that, because in his day he was as famous in the Soviet Union as Lindbergh was here. Shkalov was a test pilot, and he was the kind of test pilot that gives the bosses ulcers. This is a man who once flew a fighter under a bridge in Leningrad, on purpose. They threw him in jail for it. He was wild, he was gifted, he had hands like nobody else, and the brass couldn't decide whether to court-martial him or pin a medal on him. Eventually they did both with him, were two other men, Georgi Baidukov, the co-pilot, who was the instrument man, the fella who could fly blind in the soup when Shkalov's seat of the pants flying ran out of road. And Alexander Belyakov, the navigator, an older man, a teacher, the one with the charts and the drift site and the cold math of where exactly are we and which way is home. Three men, one airplane, and a route that ran from Moscow, up over the Arctic ice, across the actual geographic North Pole, and then down the other side of the planet into North America. Nobody had ever done it. People had died trying just to get to the pole, and these three were going to fly clean over the top of it and keep going. They'd actually tried a version of this the year before, in 36, and had to set down short up in the Soviet far north. But they'd proven the airplane could go the distance. So in the summer of 37, Stalin gave the green light, and on that cold June morning, they fired up the M-34 and started the long, groaning takeoff roll. So heavy with fuel that the airplane used up nearly the whole runway just to stagger into the air. Now I want you to climb into that cockpit with me, because this is the part the history books skip. It is loud. There's no sound insulation worth the name. Just the roar of that V-12 through a firewall a few feet from your knees, hour after hour after hour, until the noise stops being a sound and becomes a thing pressing on the inside of your skull. It is cold. Brutally cold. The cabin's barely sealed, and as they climb to clear the weather, the temperature inside drops below freezing. Frost forms on the inside of the windows, their breath hangs in the air. And then there's the oxygen. They had to climb high to get over the weather systems rolling across the Arctic, up to 19, 20,000 feet, and at that altitude, without good oxygen, you get stupid, and then you get dead. In that order, they had a limited supply of it. So they're rationing their own breathing. Think about that. You're flying the most demanding flight in human history, and you're trying to use less oxygen so at last the weather was a monster. They flew into cloud and ice. Now ice on an airplane. Ice is the quiet killer. It builds up on the wings, on the prop, on the control surfaces, adds weight where you don't want it, and ruins the shape of the wing that's holding you up. And remember those gorgeous long thin wings, the ones built for efficiency? Efficient wings hate ice. They built up ice over the Arctic, and the airplane got heavy and sluggish, and the men had to wrestle her, taking turns, one flying while the other two tried to thaw out and grab an hour of broken sleep in a space about the size of a phone booth. Belyakov, the navigator, he had the hardest job nobody talks about, because up near the pole your compass quits on you. The magnetic compass just spins useless because you're sitting right on top of where all the magnetic lines come together. So how do you navigate? You use the sun. You use a special kind of compass that works off the sun's position, and you use dead reckoning time and speed and heading, and you pray your math is right, because if you drift off course by a few degrees up there, you don't end up a little off, you end up over open ocean with no fuel and no land for 1,000 miles. They crossed the actual North Pole in the small hours. The top of the world. And there was nothing to see. No marker, no line painted on the ice, just an endless white nothing in a strange flat light, and a needle that wouldn't point anywhere. And three exhausted men in a freezing cockpit going, "Well, that's it, that's the pole. We're halfway," and the engine kept turning. That engine, 60-some hours, and that single M34 just kept running. You talk to any old-timer who flew big radials and V-12s over open water, and they'll tell you, every hour you stare at those gauges, oil pressure, oil temp, coolant, waiting for the needle that's going to ruin your day. These men did that for 2.5 days straight, with the Arctic Ocean underneath and not one place to put it down. They came down the far side of the world into Canada, into the weather and the mountains of the Pacific Northwest, fighting headwinds now that we're eating their fuel faster than the plan said they should. And here's the thing about a record-distance airplane. You plan it to the drop. You don't carry spare gas, because spare gas is weight and weight is range. So when the headwinds came up, they started doing the loneliest math in aviation. How far can we get? Where's the nearest place? Do we make it? They'd hoped to push deep into California, maybe down to San Francisco area. The fuel said no. The fuel said you're getting out now while you still get to choose where. So they came down out of the weather over the Columbia River, near Portland, Oregon, and just across the river in Vancouver, Washington, there was an Army airfield, Pearson Field. And on the morning of June 20, 1937, after 63 hours and change in the air, after more than 5,500 miles over the literal top of the planet, Valery Shkalov greased that big-winged gas can onto the grass at Pearson Field. And here's a detail I love. The base commander at Pearson at the time was a fella named General George Marshall. Yeah, that George Marshall. He hadn't the faintest idea three Russians were about to fall out of the sky into his backyard. The story goes they pretty much rolled the man out of bed. Somebody had to scramble to find anybody who spoke Russian. The townspeople of Vancouver woke up to find that the most famous airplane in the world had landed in their little field overnight, with three frozen, filthy, grinning men climbing out of it. Men who had eaten breakfast in Moscow 2 days before and were now standing in Washington State. They were heroes instantly. The whole country went nuts for it. They got a ticker tape welcome, they went to Washington, they shook hands with President Roosevelt at the White House. For one brief moment, before the world got dark and complicated, three Soviet pilots and a whole lot of Americans stood around the same airplane and just marveled at the same thing, that a man could fly from one side of the earth to the other across the pole that had killed so many. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, the way I'd be honest, sitting across a table from you, this story doesn't end soft. Valery Shkalov, the wild man, the bridge flyer, the best stick of his generation, he was dead inside a year and a half. December of 38, testing a new fighter, the engine quit on him, and rather than ride it into the houses below, he tried to stretch it to an open patch and didn't make it. He was 34 years old. The man who flew over the North Pole was killed by the same thing that's hunted every test pilot since the Wrights, an engine that stopped at the worst possible second. But you know what? They named a city after him. There's a town near Moscow called Kolovsky to this day. And out in Vancouver, Washington, there's a monument at Pearson Field to those three men. And that crazy long-winged airplane paid for partly by Russians and partly by Americans, sitting there quietly on a field most people drive past without a second look. And that's what gets me, sitting here in the hangar thinking about it. Back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, these three climbed into a single-engine airplane with no business going where it went, and they pointed it at the one place on Earth nobody had ever flown across, and they just went, no GPS, no satellite weather, a compass that quit when they needed it most. Rationing their own breath, one engine and a prayer and a navigator with a sextant and a slide rule. We fly behind glass panels now, and envelope protection and engines you can practically set your watch by. And that's good, that's progress, and I'm for it. But every now and then, it's worth remembering that all of this, all of it, was built on the backs of people who went first when going first could kill you, and who did it anyway because the map had a blank spot and they couldn't stand it. My thanks today to the folks who keep this history alive, the Pearson Air Museum out there in Vancouver, Washington, and the records the Smithsonian and the Tupolev people have kept on the NT-25. If you ever find yourself in the Pacific Northwest, go stand at Pearson Field and look at that monument and think about three cold men and one warm engine. You can find us anytime at radiohangar.com. Chkalov, Baidukov, Bilyakov. Keep their names. They earned them. I'll see you next time.